Bob, you got to get the airplane on the ground and you got to get rid of the ice. What comes first, the chicken or the egg? You concerned about getting the airplane on the ground or getting rid of the ice? What's your top priority?
Well, your top priority is to think about what you're going to do first and not be a reactionary and jump at some sort of movement. You've got to think about what your alternatives are. And as I said in the expert response, you got two elements. One is how to shed the ice, and secondly, where to go if you can't shed the ice.
Isn't it interesting, though? I mean, their first response was panic. The one guy screams emergency and hands the airplane over to the other guy. So, you know, I appreciate your point. You really got to slow down here. So the first thing you do is nothing? Wally?
Well, I wouldn't say nothing. Bob talks about making a plan, and that you certainly need to begin formulating that plan. And I think priority-wise, you need to get rid of the ice if you can. That's got to be priority number one. If you can do that, then you can land at any of these airports. Obviously, if you can't get rid of the ice, then you need to go on with that plan and say, where can I land rather quickly, I think.
With the temperature as close to freezing as it is, what's your plan, Jeff? You're at 4,000 feet. You only have so much terrain to work with, and the temps are marginal. So what's your plan for getting rid of the ice?
Well, I think Bob summed it up, and I would even say that the very first thing you need to do is make sure the airplane keeps flying, right? Which they did. I think the first steps were they fired up the power, they accelerated as much as they could. There was a little bit of back and forth over on the throttle as to how much power could be used, right? So they needed to know, you know, can I go to 40 inches of overboost? Can I go to, is it only 30 inches? Because that's what we normally cruise at. But the number one thing is, the airplane is in a stable state where you can then decide what to do. And the nice part about this is, okay, it's gotten to a stable state. We're not descending. We're not falling out of the sky. We're moving forward. The engine isn't overboosting. It's going to explode. Then we can decide. And this was based on a real scenario. And I'll even mea culpa here. I was the young CFI in the right seat as we flew through the cloud. And this Mooney iced up unbelievably fast. I had limited experience with ice until then, and I never expected that to happen. And frankly, even in icing equipped airplanes, I don't think I've experienced ice that severe since. And what actually happened was we added power, we leveled off, we told ATC we were done with doing approaches and we had a serious situation. I don't think we used the E word, and we just wanted to fly north, and we were going to descend over the water a little bit and see what happened to the ice and wait. And that's what we did. We let it settle down a little bit, and the ice started coming off in huge, loud chunks. And when it had cleared the airplane, we went back home and went out for, you know, a cup of coffee because it was still in the morning rather than a beer. But that was the real world situation, and that's how it worked out.
So in any emergency, fly the airplane first. That's what that comes down to, really.
And that's, if there's no other takeaway, that's so important, because the wrong move at the wrong time, you know, this airplane is really literally not too far away from going out of control. The airspeed you have will keep you flying, but changing the configuration, banking too much, there's a lot of ways you can aggravate this situation, and you need to be aware of those, and you need to be very conscious of those, or as you say, Bob, you're going to be reacting as opposed to flying the airplane. John, Bob talks about flying as much as 40 miles, getting the airplane on the ground. What do you think about that? Is that a little long for your...
Well, I think that's kind of the mindset of, let's go back home. Boeing Field was the home base. But if you look at the area, there was other choices. Assuming that you couldn't get rid of the ice and you did need to land, there's four 10,000-foot runways a lot closer. One of them is an Air Force base or a joint base, which could present its own set of problems, but if the situation were dire enough, that's certainly a possibility. And just because Seattle SeaTac is an air carrier airport, it's got three runways, 11,900 is the longest. If that's what I got to do, that's what I got to do. You know, I've already declared an emergency, so let's utilize whatever resources we have here.
For what it's worth, considering McCord as a joint base, if you look in the AFD, all it says is prior permission required to use it. And I think declaring the emergency constitutes your prior permission right there.
And we've talked about, you know, folks that have gone into military installations. And yes, generally we want to shy away, but the experience just doesn't bear that out. You're going to get a very, very professional crew meeting you on the ground. Yes, you'll have some issues to deal with when you're on the ground, but they're all resolvable issues versus flying an airplane that may or may not be responsive, you know, to the guys flying it.
See, and I'm going to challenge that. I think you're right that you could go to McCord. It's close by. But as Bob brought up, and we were talking about, the first thing is, let's see if the ice comes off the airplane. So I'm already heading northbound. I don't actually want to change direction. I don't want to do anything that could mess up this airplane. McCord is, at the very best, off to my right or behind me. So if my plan is, I'm flying, let me see if I can shed the ice first and then deal with a landing, well then, yeah, let me plan an airport that is some distance north of me, because that's the direction I'm going. That's where I'm going to go if I can't land. So, and SeaTac is certainly a possibility. I've got an even longer runway there. I don't have to maneuver past downtown Seattle, so that's a good idea as well. But I like the idea, actually, of planning to travel north as long as the airplane is flying.
As long as the airplane is flying. And that's the key. Okay, we've decided that the primary thing is maintaining the control. Then we got to get rid of the ice. But if we cannot get rid of the ice, and that's what we were talking about, was going back to Boeing Field and landing at 120 knots, why fly 40 miles to do that when you can fly 20? It's really, you know, it's just thinking about other options than going home. And that was the option that we were presented with.
I think there's still two advantages to going home. One is familiarity. Right. So you know the approach, you know where you're going, you're heading to it, and especially when you can't see outside the front window anyway, you're going to be on the instruments, and you want to have that advantage when you go in there. So that's a big advantage there. The second one is that we actually have a lot of altitude to work with. And we're up at 4,000 feet with ice, and the approach is going to bring us well down another 1,000, 2,000 feet with a better chance of reaching increasing temperatures and shedding the ice.
I think this comes back to the question of land as soon as possible or land as soon as practical. And in this case, the airplane is stable. So I think we're in the realm of land as soon as practical versus making a turn now with ice on the airplane to line up at an airport that's somewhat closer, than Boeing Field.
The point is just that there are other options too, and in this case, you want to keep all your options open, that's all. Don't get fixated on just going home.
How much of a discussion needs to take place in the cockpit with regard to just how vulnerable the aircraft is in its present state? You know, we've talked about the power, we've talked about the airspeed, we've talked about the ice on the airplane, but clearly, do they recognize just how close they are to this airplane becoming very unstable very, very quickly? Jeff, what would you're the new CFI, and this happened to you. You're very, very vulnerable. This needs to be acknowledged and dealt with.
Dialing into one of the things you said, they don't know how close they are. And nobody knows how close they are because every situation's different. That Mooney or a Mooney like that has never flown with exactly that amount of ice in exactly those places, right? So each situation is unique. There are now test pilots in this airplane. And that gets to the, it's flying now, don't touch anything. Don't mess with anything, to change the situation because you have no idea what's going to happen. And then when you decide, okay, we're going to make some changes in order to improve the situation, you do them judiciously and slowly. There's an interesting thing that happened in the cockpit, and this didn't happen in the real case, but we put it in a scenario here, which was we have a PIC on the left who's flying the airplane, right? And he just abdicates control, saying, "Your airplane," because the person sitting on the right has more experience. But that doesn't necessarily mean they're more qualified or they have a better plan. So yeah, the two of them talking it out. What are we going to do? We're going to fly north. Okay, we're going to descend. Okay, we're going to descend slowly. And they even had that little argument about the power, which I mentioned earlier. You know, who has the information to know how much continuous power this engine can have? You know, is there a restriction on that? If we violate the restriction, what are the repercussions of that? What can we do to mitigate it if we need 42 inches to descend at a reasonable rate? Can we do that? What's going to happen? Is the engine going to blow up? What do we have to worry about? You know, those are all things to talk about.
Two very important elements that Bob mentioned in his expert response that I think we need to zero in on. Bob, with his experience, recognized the importance of bank. And you know, most of our turns, you know, standard rate turns, whatever, those are the kind of turns that we make. Those are our normal turns. You need to proactively maintain nothing more than about 5 degrees of bank, because you really, once again, you're a test pilot, and you could quickly cause this situation to deteriorate. Bob, you also mentioned when you are going to reduce power, and that ain't going to happen for a long, long time. And for good reason. And when it does, be ready for an unexpected response. So I just want to, you know, emphasize those, because those that haven't experienced this before just don't recognize the gravity of those two things.
Absolutely, Bob. You don't know what this airplane is going to do when you take any particular action with it. Once you have a stable situation, which you do have right now, maintain that stable situation. Be very cautious in the turns and take a deep breath and don't do anything quickly without thinking about it.
There's a whole lot of, as I listen to this whole situation, this whole scenario, obviously this situation was totally preventable.
Well, we in the setup to the scenario, we don't really know what their weather study was, but it's certainly possible there might have been some pilot reports. They weren't the only airplane out there, and that might have given them a clue. That time of year, they know what the temperatures were at 3 and 5,000 feet or 6,000 feet. Certainly, knowing they're going to be in clouds, the forecast tells them where the clouds are. Certainly, they could have been obviously better prepared for this encounter.
The cockpit makeup. Mark, you want to talk a little bit about the friends flying together? One is more qualified, and what did the guy who is flying his own airplane do when, you know, they hit the wall here? He did not stay real cool, did he?
Yeah, he didn't. And that may be a continuing problem even in handling the emergency. We have the battle over the throttle, whether to do it there. You have the final abdication by the PIC of his PIC authority, handing it over to the CFI. That doesn't mean he's not going to try to take control back at some time in the future. And what you have here is hopefully not the continuation, but you're starting out without a clear designation of authority between the two pilots. A friend of mine and I, when we flew together, we had a standard rule, and it was he who is most chicken wins. And that may be, and maybe kind of a kind of a silly thing to say, but that is something that really is not clear in here. And especially when Jeff, you talk about the pilots having to reach decisions, decide whether to go on, whether to turn here, whether to turn there, somebody ultimately has to be in charge. And so far, that doesn't seem to be the case in this scenario.
And where is the point that you have that discussion? Is it at 4,000 feet in an iced up airplane, or is it before we even get in the airplane where we have the discussion about who's got the rock here, you know?
And it certainly has to be before you ever get in the airplane.
I'd like to get back to the weather issue for just a moment. Here we've got cumulus clouds. That means there's plentiful moisture in those clouds. And we've got a surface temperature of +7 Celsius. It doesn't take a lot of thought to recognize that at a standard lapse rate at 4,000 feet, you're going to be slightly below freezing, and that you're going to get ice if you go through a cumulus cloud.
Yeah, and I think that's the key there. I don't know that we can say that there was any flaw in their weather planning. They, you know, it was a visual day. They filed because they wanted to be in the system, and they're in the system. And one of the people on board said, hey, okay, well, we've got an IFR clearance. We can go through that cloud. And that, to me, was where the breakdown was. The breakdown was thinking, oh, I wasn't really thinking about this, but look, opportunity arose, and let's just take it, and we'll be through it in 30 seconds, and there'll be some nice bumps, and it'll be fine, without thinking through, wait, that's a sub-freezing cloud, and the little tip in there that it had a really clear border to it, that's a sub-freezing cloud full of water. It doesn't have that wispy, amorphous edge to it that
you
see with
ice crystals.
Right, but, sure. but there's liquid water that gives you that sharply defined edge, and that's where the person who was in the right seat should have told ATC, hey, we need to deviate around some weather.
That's where the breakdown occurred.
Right. That was the failure right there, was they had planned for one situation. It's a visual day. It's a beautiful day. There's some isolated clouds. They were well briefed for that, potentially. They moved into another situation that they actually hadn't prepared for. They weren't looking at temperatures and clouds. They weren't thinking, because there weren't that many clouds in the sky, right? It was isolated. And so it was when you, it's when you step out of your planning, I think, that you could run into that situation. They hadn't briefed that. They didn't need to brief that. What they needed to do was avoid that, right?
And I think you bring up a wonderful point there. All airplanes respond differently to ice. Know your airplane. Know your systems. Know what ice is all about. Ice can bring any airplane out of the sky. It can overpower the best pilot. So with that, we really, truly need to understand it and avoid it at all cost.
Yeah, well, and there's not even just the one kind of ice on the airplane. You brought up in your response, Bob, the tailplane stall, right? So there opens up a whole other thing, and it gets into, well, what's actually happening to our airplane if it starts buffeting? Are we stalling? Are we tailplane stalling? Do we know what the difference is? Do we know what to do? I mean, I would love to hear some more elaboration on it because I know you have more experience with that personally than I do.
You can't tell what an airplane is really going to do. I'll tell you a story that occurred maybe 35 years ago or a long time ago when I was a new instructor, and we were out with a Skylane, and we got some ice, and we wisely decided to land the airplane at Worcester, Massachusetts, because it had a fairly long runway. I think it was about 7,000 feet. And the airplane carried ice all the way down to final. We got rid of none of it. And we knew enough not to use the flaps on final. But when we got over the runway, we were going pretty fast. We were doing about 100 knots. The pilot reached over and put the flaps down. And the airplane stalled. And it went down on the nose wheel, and a Skylane pounded the nose wheel. They're particularly vulnerable for nose wheels. Fortunately, we didn't buckle the firewall on the airplane, but it was totally unexpected. As the flaps came in, the nose went down. We were probably a couple feet above the runway, and it hit the nose wheel and didn't catch the prop. We were very lucky on that, but that may have been a tailplane stall. It may have been a change in flow of air when the flaps came in that increased the angle of attack to the tail of the airplane and caused that downforce to diminish as the tail stalled.
I think, you know, we're talking about the tailplane stalls, but the example that you're giving is another indication of this assumption of PIC authority. I mean, if there's a pilot flying and somebody's in charge, nobody should be playing with anything without clearing it first.
Right.
And let's talk for just a second. This whole scenario, it struck me as soon as you introduced us to the scenario. We got a new CFI. Well, new CFIs are scary phenomena, okay? But we've all been there. And this guy is at a wonderful place in his flying career, like we all are at different phases. You've reached a new threshold. You're very proud of your accomplishments. You're reaching out for challenge. But the worst thing about a new CFI, as it is with a new pilot or new instrument pilot, is knowing what you don't know. This guy thinks it's going to be fun to be a CFI. Well, all the CFIs up there, you know, that think that, you know, flying is fun, you know, it's hard work, and you know, it's downright scary on any given day. So you need to recognize where you are in your flying career. And you know, you ask a room full of pilots, how many of you are, you know, less than average pilots? Are you going to see 50% of the room raise their hands? No, we don't look at ourselves that way. But knowing yourself, being in touch with the reality of who you are, and in this situation, you know, these two guys together did not add up to one complete pilot, you know, because they didn't know how they were going to interact with each other. Wally?
We all tell people when they get their private pilot certificate that now you've received a license to learn. We say that. But don't forget, each time you get a new certificate, you receive a license to learn at a whole different level. And that's what happened to this new instructor this time. He certainly didn't intend or want to be in this position. He found himself there rather quickly.
So what the other thing that I think needs to be recognized here, once again, we're all individuals. All of us has different personalities. We've learned from different people. We're at different points in our life. Do we know how we're going to respond to a panic situation? Jeff, you were the new CFI here. You know, how much panic had you been exposed to? And were you ready? You know, I'll put you on the spot here. You know, Maybe you were, maybe you weren't.
You know, in the real world situation, nobody panicked. We were surprised for sure. But there was no actual panic in those moments. And that's one of those places, I think, where if you can get past the first blush, which is, for me, in serious situations and emergencies through my flying career, I have to say the first thing that went through my mind in each of those situations was, oh my gosh, this is actually happening. You know, that was it wasn't, oh, I have to do something. It wasn't, oh, this can't be true. It was this slow realization. This isn't a dream. This isn't a story. This isn't practice. I'm actually in this plane and probably have to do something about this. And that burned up, you know, a fraction to a whole second or two, you know, it seems like forever. But once you get past that, if you can focus on the task at hand, that seems to push a lot of those things away. And that's where good training comes in. And that's what actually happened in the real cockpit. We both went, okay. And then dealt with flying the airplane. So I think that's the way you deal with that situation. Panic is a real underminer, if you will, of being able to act coherently and appropriately. And even if you have to just breathe for a moment to recenter yourself, do it.
That's what I call taking a deep breath. That's what you did.
I think I've mentioned this before in the roundtables. I used to know someone who was a B-52 pilot, and they had the mechanical clock. The older B-52s had an actual wind-up clock sitting on the glare shield there. And he said the first thing they were told to do when there was a situation that came up was wind the clock.
Oh, you know. Of course, they had eight engines to work.
Yeah, right. But if, you know, still, if one is on fire, you know, that's the thing. And that was his thing. He said, yeah. So a fire light comes on. Do you put the fire out on the engine? No, you wind the clock. And that gives you enough time to say, is it a fire or is it a light that came on, but there is no fire? Look at the other indications. Think about it. Wait, there's nothing else that says it's an engine fire. Maybe it's not. Maybe I don't need to, you know, shut down one of my eight engines.
A lot of lessons here, you know, right from the crew setup to getting a better crew briefing to a little bit more effective weather planning, checking on PIREPs. And then when the situation, the unexpected, does occur, you know, stay cool. The airplane's still flying. Logically, take a second to go through and make the right move. Don't compound the situation. Don't make it worse. And then decide whether you need to get the airplane on the ground right now or whether you have time to do it under control. When you do that, it's going to bring you safely to the ground.